And now, with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved, here is Dr. James Hauck.
Okay, all right. Good evening, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to another Reclaiming Authenticity broadcast. Reclaiming that which has always been in you. In fact, helping you reclaim who you have always been. And I sincerely believe that. And I'll say a little bit more here coming up as to why I believe that we are able to reclaim who we always have been, to remember who we are, and therefore how, as we are empowered, how to live as that soul in this world. I'm Dr. James Hauck, and if you would like more information about me, or maybe you'd want to leave me your comments about tonight's show, I just invite you to visit that website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's all one word. Or if you want to visit my personal website, it is www.reclaiming-authenticity.com. So it's www.reclaiming-authenticity.com. So leave me your comments. I always like to get feedback from the listeners out there and what they think of the show, as well as getting some ideas for future shows. And if you can't wait till the end of the show and you would like to call in, just be part of the tonight's topic, that number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I will be taking your calls after the break, about halfway through the show. And tonight's show is something that, I wrestled with a good bit. It's entitled Out of the Depths, Towards a Contemplative Life. And like I said, this was a topic which I sat with for several weeks. You know, it just kept coming back to me. And it's like, what is it about this contemplation? And I'm definitely one that wholeheartedly believes in contemplation. But what is it about people who hit rock bottom, or people who are frustrated with their lives, or people who don't know what else to do, nowhere to turn, so on and so forth? And it's out of that depth that they are then cry out, and their cries are heard, and their lives are then put on this trajectory of, from that point on, they are living a contemplative life. One of just introspection, one of just taking the time to, you know, who am I? Where is my life going? Where do I find meaning and purpose? What do I have to give up? What do I then take on? How do I live as a soul? And so on and so on and so on. All that is approached through this discipline called contemplation. So happy to have you here this evening. And just want to say at the outset that each and every one of these broadcasts, I dedicate to the integration of our spirituality and our mental health, but I place it all within the context of our relationships, the relationships that we have with ourselves, the relationships that we have with one another, and certainly with our relationship with God or the divine. So I just want to also say that just in case you cannot spend the entire hour with me this evening, these broadcasts are also podcasted. In case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows, any shows that you want. And I believe, I'm in my fifth year of doing these shows, and I think all of them are available to you. So if you want to go back and listen to, you know, the early days of this broadcast, that's always exciting because, yes, I am not the same person I was when I first started out, but I had a lot of fun. So, again, you would just go on the bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity website and just make sure you click on Station 1, or you can type in my name or just type in Reclaiming Authenticity, and you'll be able to access the archives. And just want to also remind you that in case you have nothing to do on the weekend, especially Saturday morning, Saturday afternoons, this show replays on WNEW 102.7 FM, like I said, on the weekends. Now, for people who might be tuning in for the very first time, I just want to share with you and everybody just my heartfelt gratitude. Just thank you for taking the time out and spend this hour with me this evening. But I also want to share for people for the first time, you know, my two deep-seated beliefs that have really helped shape my outlook on why I call this reclaiming authenticity, okay? And just why I believe that, you know, reclaiming that which has always been in you, discovering the gifts and the strengths and the skills and the resiliency and so forth, but also helping you reclaim who you have always been. Because again, as I'll talk about tonight with the contemplation, the more we contemplate on our lives, the more we get in touch with the things that, let's say, hold us back, or the things that block a full awareness of who we are as souls. As those things begin to break up, as those things begin to heal in our lives, that awareness of who we are slowly comes back to us. And we were reminded that, yeah, this is what I'm called to do, or this is how I'm supposed to live my life, and I have everything I need. So again, the two deep-seated beliefs that have really helped shape my outlook on reclaiming authenticity. The first one is that I truly believe that people have the answers within themselves, because after all, you know the kind of life that you want to live, and you know how you presently feel. You know what brings you peace and joy and hope and contentment, and you know what doesn't, okay? And there's a great quote I've been sharing for several broadcasts now from Ralph Waldo Emerson that really is meant to be encouraging to us, that he writes that what lies behind us and what lies before us, these are tiny matters compared to what lies within us. So I certainly believe that people have the answers within themselves. And I often take people and like, let's go find those answers. Because I don't look at people as, their problems. I have to give them a mental health diagnosis. That's all part of the system in which I work. But I don't reduce them to, let's say, depression or anxiety or whatever their issue might be that they're struggling with. They see them as people who have the answers of how they would like to live. Well, the second deep-seated belief is that I truly believe that everybody comes into this world with what they already need for in this life in terms of their gifts, their talents, their skills, their graces, etc., etc. In other words, the very best parts of who you are. So we not only have the answers within us, but we have everything that we need for in this life. We just need to go look for it. We need to find it. What gets in the way of that? Where do I need to be healed? And so on and so forth. Because it's all within us. We came into the world with some beautiful, beautiful gifts and beautiful skills that are not meant exclusively for us, but they are meant to be shared with others. And others share their gifts and talents and skills with us, and so on and so forth. But you know as well as I do that, you know, we go through life, you know, and we're going to experience maybe some pretty unpleasant events, or maybe we found ourselves at times being in the wrong place at the wrong time, and we end up suffering some traumatic injuries. And even though we may have had these experiences, you know, there's always this temptation to forget that we are already full of value, dignity, and worth. Again, that is who we are. And we forget that we have that value, dignity, and worth. But also, there is this temptation to, we want to hide that giftedness, or we want to hide the best parts of ourselves so that, let's say, maybe others won't exploit them into the future. Or maybe we started to share our giftedness with others and they didn't really know how much of a gift it was. And they trampled on it or something. You know, either way, our feelings were hurt. But, you know, whenever we hide our giftedness, whenever we don't allow people to see the best of who we are, you know, we're going to run the risk of going through this life living from a place of that woundedness or that victimization, instead of living from a place of healing and wholeness and empowerment. And, you know, the reason why we may want to hide our giftedness from ourselves and even others, and live from a place of woundedness or victimhood, is basically rooted in the ignorance of what we have taken in through our five senses, sight, sound, taste, touch, and smell. And I've been talking about this at the beginning of my shows for a couple of months now, that, you know, these five senses and the empirical evidence, let's say, that we can measure, all very limited, you know, and in the end, you know, we take that to be the end all be all truth. Okay. And we often rely on our senses all the time. You know, in other words, if I can hear something, well, then that's my truth. It must be true. And if I can see something, well, then that's my truth. It must be true. And if we experience enough negativity about ourselves, well, then is that our truth? Well, I don't think so. But elsewhere, you know, if I can touch something, then that's my truth, then it must be true, as well as other sensory-related experiences we believe to be that end-all, be-all truth. However, you know, these sensory perceptions are limited because, you know, and this is how we're hardwired here, folks, that whatever we take in through the brain, okay, you know, what we see, you know, the mind comes in and automatically wants to slap a label on it and interprets what we have seen and heard and tasted and touched and smelled based on our past but very limited experiences. And we tend to forget that the holiest and most transformative experiences really touch the soul. You know, the mind can't follow those things. The mind is also very limited, but it interprets, but something that's very limited in its scope. So again, by way of encouragement, don't go off searching for something you already are. Discover who you are and be that soulful presence in the world. I mean, the full realization of who we are as souls really liberates us. And as we're reminded, you know, of that famous quote from Jesus, who once stated, "The truth sets us free." And in that context, he was pointing to a higher truth, that we are all souls connected to God since the beginning. And we are not exclusively the body, but we embrace the fullness and the ability to live as lighted souls in the world. Well, in her book, A Return to Love, one of my favorite authors, Marianne Williamson, writes, "We are all meant to shine, as children do. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone." And this is the whole point of reclaiming authenticity, helping people discover, again, what has always been in them, as well as who you have always been as a soul. And yet, ironically, just as we experience our woundedness in the context of relationships, it's also within the context of healthier relationships that we can find our healing, our voice, and our authentic selves. But there's difficulty here. It's often finding the courage to discover that which has always been in you. And this is where contemplation comes in. This is where, you know, people begin, and like, out of the depths, I cry. And that leads them to the path of introspection, contemplation, and so forth. You see, discovering what has always been in us, you know, and I'm talking about here, you know, these gifts and graces and skills, and let's not forget our uniqueness that we've come into the world with. It's this Latin word I love. It's just called hacetas. It's a thisness. It's, you know, something that John Duns Scotus, he was a Scottish Franciscan who lived, or maybe he died in early 1300s. And, you know, hachetas, everybody has a thisness to themselves. Okay. And, you know, as I try to explain it to kids, it's like, okay, you have two kids here. And, you know, it's like, I don't know, help me rake some leaves. I know kids aren't going to want to do that, but just humor me here. Okay. So I asked two kids to help me rake leaves. Well, they're going to do it according to their thisness. Okay. Their own kind of skill, their own uniqueness. Or if they're, you know, wanting to draw a picture or play an instrument, they're going to do that with, you know, according to their own uniqueness. You know, two people can play the same musical instrument, but no two people are going to play it the same because of this hachetas, because of the thisness. And everybody has a thisness, you know. But, you know, maybe in our past, perhaps we didn't feel as though we, you know, didn't live up to another person's expectation of us. Or perhaps we hid our uniqueness from others in order to survive maybe abuse. Or perhaps those aspects of ourselves that have been taken away from us and we just didn't have the strength to fight that. Well, either way, whenever we become aware that we have done these things, it takes tremendous courage to reclaim who we are. And we can reclaim our voice, our uniqueness, our thisness. We can discover again the very best of who we are because we've always had it. You know, it is hard for us to grasp the reality that, let's say, as a soul, that we existed prior to taking on the physical, you know, a body that gives form to our formless souls. And I love the passage in the Bible where God was calling Jeremiah to be a prophet. And of course, Jeremiah's like, can you do somebody else? I'm only a kid. You know, I don't really know how to speak. You know, the same old comments, you know, of just people making excuses as if God didn't really think it through. And God comes back. And I think, you know, this is not only meant for Jeremiah, but it's also meant for us today. You know, he says to Jeremiah, look, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. What did God know? Before we were formed, before we took on this flesh, God knew us as a soul. You know, and later, and you know, he tells Jeremiah, you know, before you were born, I already set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations, and it goes on from there. Wonderful calling in the early on in the book of Jeremiah. But imagine that. Before we were formed in the womb, God knew us. What did that look like? What did God see? And what do we need to see and to realize ourselves as that soul, as God sees us and has always seen us? You know, it's hard for us to grasp that reality that we existed prior to taking on a body, prior to being born, you know, as we know it. But, you know, we often limit ourselves to settling for the form. That is this empirical evidence that we can measure through the form, you know, what the eyes can see or what the ears can hear or what the hands can hold and so on and so forth. But, you know, as a result, we often give up exploring higher truths about ourselves because really when it comes to matters of the soul, how are you going to measure that? I mean, do you get out the bathroom scale? Do you get out a tape measure? Do you, you know, plug in your radar device? Who knows? Okay, but you can't do that because the soul is boundless and eternal, and therefore its truths are experienced from life to life and soul to soul. So again, this is what reclaiming authenticity is all about, you know, and I like to sum it up in one word, namaste, which roughly translated, and yeah, I'm taking liberties with it, but it fits, you know, it's because I see myself as a soul of light. This allows me to greet the lighted soul of who you are, even if you don't see it in yourself. Well, again, welcome to tonight's show, Out of the Depth, Towards a Contemplative Life. Well, you know, I believe it's quite common these days You know, that whenever we consider words like introspection, observation, contemplation, and reflection, you know, these are words that most people find difficult to relate to, let alone. What does it mean to implement introspection and contemplation in our busy lives? In fact, we might even have said at some point, well, my life is so busy, I wish I had time to sit quietly with my thoughts, or even engage in some form of meditation. Yeah, understandably so. You know, our lives get busy. However, these words, observation, contemplation, reflection, and introspection, convey the backbone of living a transformative and transcendent life. And, you know, aren't we already engaging in some form of contemplating and reflecting on events in our lives? Perhaps in terms of, well, we ruminate on past conversations or actions. Or maybe we tell ourselves over and over and over again, well, I should have done that. I could have done that. And, you know, if it wasn't for this, I even would have done this. We've all done this to a certain degree. But how often do we really quiet our hearts and get serious about searching for the direction and answers to our lives? Contemplation. Well, I also believe that it takes great wisdom, and I mean great wisdom, to approach these words with a serious intention, because we need to be fully prepared to embrace where this transformative journey is going to take us. You see, all of us have stories of the many roads our lives had taken based on our decisions and experiences. And yet, deciding to engage in a contemplative life takes us on an inward journey in discovering who we are and have always been. And then, how should we be living as a soul in this world? And that's the transcendent piece. Where does it take us beyond our limitations? Where does it take us out of our comfort zones, and so forth? You know, and certainly not for the faint of heart, people, but, you know, this inward journey is certainly going to lead us to confront our fears, our own prejudices, maybe our own resentments, our bitterness, maybe even ingratitude, and maybe even hatred. But these wounds keep us from discovering these higher truths about ourselves and how to learn to walk in forgiveness, gratitude, and love. Those things, those fears, prejudices, resentments, bitterness, ingratitude, hatred, and so on, get in the way. They cloud our vision. They keep us in fear. They, you know, cannot be worked through if we don't engage in contemplation and allow the things that we need to heal from to really act as our teachers to show us what else and where else do we need to heal. Well, I'm certain that you have heard the saying from the Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu that a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, meaning that no matter how difficult a task or a venture or whatever is, you can conquer it if you first start it. And quite often, what is needed to take this first step is an attitude of surrender and courage. And that's another piece of this in Out of the Depths I Cry and On to This Contemplative Life. The first step is having this attitude of, I surrender. I can't do it my way. And it also requires much, much courage to face the things and to discover who we are. Well, you know, something I do every Good Friday, which was, you know, a few days back, you know, right before Easter, is that I typically read De Profundis by Oscar Wilde. Now, De Profundis is Latin, and it refers to Psalm 130, and it's traditionally known as Out of the Depths from its opening words in Latin. And the first step is a call to God in deep, deep sorrow from out of the depths or out of the deep. And so the psalm actually starts off, out of the depths I cry to you, Lord. Lord, hear my voice. Hear my cry. Let your ears be attentive to my cry for mercy. Because if you, O Lord, kept the record of sins, who could stand? But with you there is forgiveness, so that we can, with reverence, serve you. Out of the depths, I cry to you. And Oscar Wilde didn't just pick this out of the blue. You know, here's the backstory as to why he wrote De Profundis. Great read, by the way. He was sentenced to, you know, back in his day, he was sentenced to, I think, 2 years of hard labor, and because he had lived a very, let's say, a promiscuous lifestyle. He had a lot of promiscuous relations and shady deals. And, you know, as his last name implied, Wilde went wild. And, you know, he went from the, say, the heights of the London society all the way down to being bankrupt. And then he was incarcerated. And then he was just faced with public, you know, mockery and, you know, just faced a lot of indignity and so forth. And, you know, so adding insult to injury, you know, now, you know, during his trial, you know, information was brought out that he had a romantic relationship with then Lord Alfred Douglas, which also became the subject for gossip around town and so forth. And then he was locked up and so forth. But however, it's far more than a passionate writing of Oscar Wilde. You know, De Profundis, out of the depths, I cry to you. It actually charts Oscar Wilde's humiliating downfall and just the rejection of his very indulgent way of living, you know, and then he had this awareness. He had this epiphany. You know, he just like, look, what I did before, I don't know who that was. Can't believe I did all these things, you know, and to the point where I just lived this cavalier lifestyle and this attitude to where I just never took notice, or I even wanted to take notice of how I was hurting others. And so, you know, this is the only work that Oscar Wilde wrote in prison, you know, in the 2 years. And this was actually the last work that, you know, in like a prose narrative he ever wrote. The manuscript, which he wrote, was then entrusted to his dear friend, Robert Ross, or he called Robbie, who was his sometime lover and you know, his just adamant supporter. And Oscar Wilde writes in De Profundis, you know, he says that when he was first put into prison, he said that some people came up to him and told him, you know, just try and forget who you are, which he didn't find any comfort in that. You know, he found to be, that's some pretty bad advice. But instead, he wrote that, you know, it was only in realizing what I am that I have found comfort of any kind. But as he spent time in that prison and he contemplated, there you go, contemplated his anguish in that prison, he realized also that where there is sorrow, there is holy ground. But Wilde didn't stop there, because later on he writes in De Profundis that a sinner must repent. But why? You know, why is repentance important? You know, because he wrote simply because otherwise he would be unable to realize what he had done. In other words, the moment of repentance is the moment of this initiation. And this awareness was his turning point that led him out of the depths and toward a contemplative life. Well, I would really love to hear your heart on these matters. So again, if you would like to call in, that number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. Be back with you in 1 minute.
Ooh.
everybody. Welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you're listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. You know, early in the show, I was talking about how I believe it takes great wisdom to approach the concepts such as introspection, observation, contemplation, and reflection, because these words carry with them a serious intention to be fully prepared to embrace where this transformative journey will take us. And it's going to take us on a journey. I can, you know, many people say, oh yeah. Whenever they started, definitely not the same person that they was when they started, you know, living a contemplative life. Okay. But, you know, we all have stories on just, you know, experiences, and I'm not talking about the fish stories or the one that got away, you know, but different paths and many roads our lives have taken, which were based on our decisions and our experiences. Okay. And certainly this contemplative life does take us on an inward journey, you know, discovering of who we are and have always been, and as well as how we should be living as a soul. And I had shared right before the break that something I do every Good Friday is I read De Profundis by Oscar Wilde, which translated from the Latin refers to, you know, Psalm 23, the opening verse, you know, out of the depths, like out of the depths, I cry to you, O Lord. Okay. And Oscar Wilde spent a couple of years in prison, and that's where he really hit his bottom. That was where he really found the depth and the depths and the deep that he found himself in. And, you know, I don't know if he said, I have nowhere to go but up, but I am reminded of this Psalm 130. And so out of the depths, I cry to you, O Lord, hear my voice, hear my cry. Okay. And from that point on, you know, he writes De Profundis, and very profound reading. I highly, highly recommend it if you never have. Or if you have, I mean, go back and read it again. It is well worth the extra reading. And, you know, it is just amazing that contemplation is a powerful endeavor, you know, because contemplation, you know, is nothing to be afraid of, even though it takes courage to change from what we have known and what we know currently as, let's say, comfortable, to something that invites us to heal and eventually heal others. Because contemplation, okay, if it is done in the right attitude of that surrender, will bring us to a place of vulnerability and perceive all that which we think is lacking in ourselves. But much more than this, contemplation also brings us to a place of realization of our potential for transformation and transcendence. You know, years ago, I really struggled with, you know, trying to understand the difference between transformation and transcendence. I mean, I would really struggle with this, you know, because I would ask myself, I wonder what comes first. Is it transcendence and then we transform? Or do we transform first and then there's transcendence? You know, do we wait until we are transformed in some way and then we transcend or we go beyond our limitations? Like, in, does that transformation somehow, some way empower us? Okay. Or do we sit tight and wait until we are able to transcend our limitations? Do we do that first? And then somewhere along the process of stepping outside of our comfort zones, we are then transformed. Well, it's actually a both and. Transcendence and transformation can occur at the same time. Do you know, this awareness of, you know, out of the depths that I cry, and this contemplative life and this transformation, transcendence, transformation actually reminds me of you know, the recovery process from folks who are, you know, trying to stay clean and sober, let's say alcohol. And often they use the 12 steps. And, you know, again, if you've never read the 12 steps of AA, again, it's a good read. But I just want to, like, just speak on the first four steps, because this is powerful. This goes right along with, you know, out of the depths, I cry to you. And this, I'm now on a path of contemplation, which is going to lead me to find transformation and transcendence and transcendence and transformation. And step one certainly speaks of honesty. You know, right off the bat, we admit that we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. I mean, that step goes right to the heart of the matter, doesn't it? Denial. I mean, people often spend a lot of time denying that they either have a problem or believing that, well, I can quit whenever I want to. Yeah, famous last words. Okay. So the first step towards any recovery is admitting you have a problem and you are powerless to help yourself. Sounds like out of the depths I cry to you, O Lord. Okay. And step two speaks of hope. We have come to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I mean, people in recovery from addictions often find faith in God or a higher power or something greater than themselves. You know, so out of the depths, I cry to you, O Lord, Lord, hear my voice, hear my cry. And then there's step three, which really speaks of faith, in that we make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand who God is. And, you know, a major hurdle in this step is recognizing that we have to let go of our egos that are always with us. And we have to let go of those egos and surrender by relying on something, someone greater than ourselves to help us walk this new path of sobriety. And then just lastly, there are 12 steps, but I just want to do four. You know, lastly, you know, step four really speaks of courage, that we make a decision to search ourselves. Ooh, there's contemplation again. We make a decision to search ourselves and to take a moral inventory of ourselves. More introspection. In other words, we evaluate our past character and behavior so that we can identify what we need to let go of and take on a new way of transforming our growing edges and our woundedness that contributed to the addiction. And this honest appraisal definitely takes tremendous courage, because people, you know, at this step, they have to confront some pretty painful and often very uncomfortable perceptions and understanding about themselves. And just with the first four steps of AA, this, you know, the process of one, out of the depths, I cry and surrender, two, contemplation, introspection, and three, transformation, all lead us to the ability to transcend and go beyond a life of woundedness and towards a life of further contemplation, healing, and growth. But you know what? That's only the beginning. Because as I said, I really struggled with this, you know, which comes first, transformation or transcendence? I mean, do we wait until we're transformed and then we're able to go past our limitations? Or do we wait until we go past our limitations and then somewhere in that process of stepping outside our comfort zones, are we transformed? Well, as I said, it's a both and, because these things happen at the same time. And I want to share with you now just some stories of people who, you know, out of the depths, ride out to God and were put on a path of contemplation. And they experienced this transformation, transcendence, transformation in very, very powerful ways. And as I was really wrestling with what comes first, transformation or transcendence, the story that I would, you know, read first was of Francis of Assisi, and as he's referred to now as Saint Francis. But Francis grew up as a part of the wealthy merchant class in the late 1100s AD. He was the one who founded the religious friars. You know, he just kind of like renounced everything and like, I'm going to go serve God. You know, and he did so by embracing a life of poverty and chastity. Okay, never married. Okay, never had any sexual relations. Okay. He went around and he preached salvation to everyone, except for one particular group. The one group he was afraid of the most. And that was the lepers. See, the lepers in his day, nobody really wanted to be around. In fact, it is said that if a leper was going around begging for food or out walking or just living somewhere, they always had to wear a bell around their neck. And if they ever, you know, saw somebody coming, they would have to ring the bell, or as they would walk, the bell would ring. But if they did see somebody, they would have to call out, "Unclean, unclean," so that the person would know that they have leprosy and not to come near them. I mean, talk about a very lonely, painful life to live. And Francis, he was just like, I'll do anything for you, God, but I cannot be around this group of people. And many times, you know, Francis had visions, he had dreams, you know, and he considered himself doing good work, but he never confronted that one fear. That was until one day after he had a vision of the cave, St. Francis encountered a leper. You know, and many lepers dwelt near Assisi, and there was a hospital for the lepers not far outside the city, okay? And as I said, Francis, he couldn't stand the sight of them, and he couldn't stand the smell of them, and he would either walk far away from them, or he was even known by one of his companions to run away in the other direction. And, you know, Francis just like, I don't want to come face to face with a man half eaten by such a disease. But Francis had to make a choice, you know, believing that if God could love him with all of his sinfulness, who was he not to love people with leprosy? And the fascinating story is he heard the bell. He heard, you know, this person walking, and he heard, "Unclean, unclean." And he said, "I had to get down off of my horse. My mind was saying, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it." And yet his body, his soul was saying something else. And he was actually walking toward a person with leprosy. And he approached the leper, and they stood there for the longest time just looking at each other. And finally, Francis bent down and kissed him on one of his open sores. And he said in that moment, he experienced the most incredible grace. You know, he writes, what before seemed bitter was changed into sweetness. And convicted of his former hatred for people with leprosy, Francis made his way to the leper hospital and then there apologized to them for his previous behaviors. He then showed them compassion, and he spent some time there serving them with great devotion and love. Transformation or transcendence? What comes first? Does it really matter when it comes to seeing another person as a soul and not a disease? Well, there's another famous story out there of one who cried out, you know, out of the depths and was put on this path of contemplation. And I am talking about the one and only Alice Cooper. Alice Cooper. You know, his faith journey is a story of returning to his Christian roots after a period of rock and roll, let's say, excess. You know, he grew up in a Christian family, ironically. You know, he had Christian roots. His father was a pastor. His grandfather was a pastor, I think. And so he becomes this rock star, okay? And along with being a rock star, you know, Alice Cooper, whose real name is Vincent Damon Furnier, he gets caught up in the rock and roll lifestyle of fame and fortune and drugs and alcohol. You know, not everybody who does rock and roll gets caught up in those things, but Alice Cooper certainly did. And yet he comes to this realization that no matter how much success, you know, no matter how much success and worldly pleasures he can experience, he never had a sense of being fulfilled and at peace. me. He once described it as like, I walked around, but I felt like I had this God-shaped hole in my heart. Something was missing. I just wasn't happy. And ironically, he also shared, you know, the many, many interviews that he had done, and also the book that he wrote, Welcome to My Nightmare, the Alice Cooper story. He shared that he started to attend church with his wife, Cheryl, and he slowly became reacquainted with his Christian roots. And yet, there was still one problem. He needed to address once and for all his battle with alcoholism and addiction. So he sought help. He became sober. He found a new purpose and strength in his faith in Christ. And now he's still out there willingly sharing his testimony, and he encourages others who struggle with addictions to also seek their own faith and to find hope. Again, what comes first? Transformation, transcendence. Transcendence, transformation. Does it really matter? Let me share one more story with you. Another, I would say, heavy metal rocker, although, you know, he would probably say I'm a new metal person. And this is Brian Welch from the group Horn. And Brian Welch got the nickname Head from his band members. Kind of looks like Jesus with cornrows, you know, no offense. Okay. But I mean, that's what he looks like, you know, just head to toe, tatted up. And, you know, gifted guitarist. Okay. And he was given the nickname Head by his band members because, you know, everybody said, well, your head's kind of too big for the rest of your body. And then it stuck from there. So anyway, yeah, he was the founding member and guitarist of Korn with a K, K-O-R-N. He was raised in Bakersfield, California. And growing up, it was really hard for him because he was bullied in school. I mean, severely bullied. But he liked music. And he writes in his own book, you know, Save Me From Myself. He writes that he was a huge Ozzy Osbourne fan. Now, originally, Brian Welch wanted to play the drums. But listen to this. His father convinced him to play the guitar so that he wouldn't have to haul a drum kit around. So he began playing the guitar at age 10. Later on, he formed the band Korn, which was and still is classified as a new NU metal band, you know, by how they include elements of alternative metal. And sometimes they're referred to as hard rock, but they're definitely a metal band. But he too got caught up in the new metal rock lifestyle. But again, nothing about his life satisfied him. And he too had a conversion experience, which again, he explains in his book, Save Me From Myself, where he explained, you know, he said, look, I was walking along just one day, just doing my rock and roll thing, making millions of dollars, you know, success and everything, addicted to drugs. Then the next day I had this revelation of Christ. I don't know if Christ appeared to him. Again, does it really matter? But he had this revelation of Jesus. And he was like, everything changes now. From this point on, everything changes. And so, again, he writes, you know, that it was in March of 2005, you know, he was baptized in the Jordan River over there in Israel with a group of believers from his church. And he has now declared that he has rid himself of all drugs in his own personal rehab that he found with God, in which he had checked into a hotel room and he sat in his bed for hours and never touched another drop of alcohol or drugs. And finally, one last story. This is the story of John Newton. Does that name ring a bell? It should, but he wasn't a rocker, you know, like Alice Cooper or, you know, Brian Welch, but he wrote the words to Amazing Grace. He wrote that way back in 1772, John Newton. And again, you know, what I share with you is from the book Amazing Grace, The Life of John Newton, and a surprising story behind his song. And ironically, you know, young John, you know, his father was very intimidating. His father was a ship's captain that really instilled fear in John from an early age, you know, and I think he was like 6 years old that young John snuck out a night to see a dead body that was hung near the docks early that night. And early on, his mother dies of consumption, his father remarries, and John is sent to boarding school, and there he experiences more beatings from the headmasters. And, you know, back in those days, it was definitely part of the slave trade, okay? And, you know, Newton wasn't exactly in favor with his faith and the church. I mean, in fact, he really spoke out against it because, again, he goes on to being a ship captain like his father. And he cursed and he carried on. He drank and he just like denounced the church and everything. And, you know, despite a promising start with a slaver, you know, working on a ship off the coast of Sierra Leone, he was struck with malaria. He recovered, but soon he had to face yet another trial. Newton was aboard a ship one night, you know, he was the captain, and a violent storm breaks out. And the crew was terrified at the strength of the storm. But again, ironically, Newton calmly walks out on deck and he shouts, "Men, if we are going to be saved from this storm, it's only going to be by the grace of God." That's it. He calmly goes back to his cabin, and that's where it hit him. He had this realization of like, wait a minute, what did I just say? And it was in that moment that after he left the deck, one of the crewmen who had taken his place was swept overboard. Okay. And again, he just had this powerful conversion experience of like, how could, you know, somebody like that, you know, I could have been me, you know, but he has this powerful transformation. And he goes on to renounce the slave trade, and he goes on to pen the words to the song, "Amazing Grace," one of the most recognizable hymns ever to be written. Transcendence, transformation, transformation, transcendence. Does it really matter when the two go hand in hand? "Out of the depths, I cry to you, O Lord. O Lord, hear my cry." Well, and all of those stories and all of the people who have ever cried out from the depths, they go on this path of contemplation, transformation, transcendence. Because please keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, that if you ever reach a point in your life when all you have is a prayer that comes from the cry of your soul, that's enough. I guarantee you that cry will be heard. Thank you for spending this hour with me. You have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Haupt. Tune in with me in 2 weeks from tonight. I'll be sharing more stories, more thoughts on reclaiming authenticity and how we rediscover ourselves as a soul. But in the meantime, may everybody be well. May everybody behave. And by all means, everybody be safe. Good night.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding around to buy a book by Dr. Hauk, it's all there. Just wander over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, on BBS Radio TV.